Blog Talk Radio.
I was toting my pack along the dusty Winnemucca Road, when along came a semi with a high-end canvas covered load. If you're going to Winnemucca, Mac, with me you can ride. And so I climbed into the cab and then I settled down inside. He asked me if I'd seen a road with so much dust and sand, and I said, listen, I've traveled every road in this here land. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the deserts bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I travel, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Reno, Chicago, Fargo, Minnesota, Buffalo, Toronto, Winslow, Sarasota, Wichita, Tulsa, Ottawa, Oklahoma, Tampa, Panama, Mattawa, La Paloma, Bangor, Baltimore, Salvador, Amarillo, Tocopilla, Barranquilla, and Padilla. I'm a killer. I've been everywhere, man. I've been everywhere, man. Across the desert, bare, man. I breathe the mountain air, man. I've traveled, I've had my share, man. I've been everywhere. I've been to Boston, Charleston, Dayton, Louisiana, Washington, Houston.
It's time for the next edition of the Riveting Jumble Justice Radio Show, broadcast worldwide on Blog Talk Radio. Turn up your speakers and listen closely, since you may be asked questions later. Keep your phone handy, since we encourage you to call in your comments to the host and guests on today's show. The listener call-in number is 347-996-5983. Once again, the number is 347-996-5983. You will also find the number on the top of the homepage for the Jumble Justice Radio Show. I'm Audrey, your technical and spiritual advisor for the radio broadcast. And now, without further delay, allow me to introduce your eminently qualified and inspiring host for Jumble Justice, Professor Keith Haley.
Thank you very much, Audrey. Thank you again. What show number is this? 14,621. No, it's not quite that many. It just seems like that. Audrey, thank you for getting us hooked up one more time on the Blog Talk Radio Network, that is. And we want to also thank Mike Sorrento and Lucy Spears. Lucy's not here tonight, but we'll talk with her later. Okay, welcome to the Blog Talk Radio Network and the Jumble Justice Radio Show. And we have a fine speaker tonight who's going to be interviewed, and her name is Emily Miller. And I want to give you a little prompt here ahead of time about her. She has a book called Emily Gets Her Gun. And let me give you the brief background to this, and I'll comment more on it later, but it's an incredible story. She's a senior editor, opinion editor for the Washington Times newspaper, and she lives in Washington, D.C., and she came home once, and she'll tell you about it in the interview, but she came home once, and she was the victim of a home invasion type of assault at her home, and she decided she wanted to get a firearm, where the District of Columbia did not permit any type of handguns whatsoever that you could have. And then finally, the United States Supreme Court here, not too far back, ruled in D.C. versus Heller, District of Columbia versus Heller, that they couldn't do that, that cities could not restrict them from having firearms. And so what happened is they did say that they could have regulations to get them. So what she did is decided she's going to get a gun, because she wants the right to protect herself, as most Americans would want in a free society. So she went down to do this, and when she went down to the police station, I think she started there and told them, I'd like to get a gun. There's 17 different steps, and while she was going through this process, they added five more, like 22 different steps to get a firearm in the District of Columbia, and she finally made it. So one of the things you can do, you can also go to the Washington Times website, Washington Times, you can just Google it, and then in the search box up there, type in Emily Gets Her Gun. There's like an 8 or 9 part series in there of articles where she writes about what she went through to get this thing. And some of these things are just incredible. I'm so stupid. I mean, you wouldn't believe it. But anyway, we want to thank Johnny Cash for getting us off again tonight. Somebody else was telling me today about Johnny Cash, how he was a Bible scholar. He really studied the Bible. most people remember him for other things, but certainly an interesting character. The purpose of this show is to look at news issues and events and developments in this always difficult and sometimes humorous practice of criminal justice. And guns is certainly a big issue. This show is dedicated to these police and courts, corrections, and juvenile justice professionals. Most of you I'm not going to comment on because it takes a long time. We don't know enough or know everything about this incident on the Capitol today where the woman ran into the barricades of the White House and then took off in the car, and the cops stopped her, and they ended up shooting her. Emily Carey, I think was her name, 34 years old, maybe only 24, and she had a one-year-old child in the car, and the cops ended up killing her. But I don't know how they, well, if you look at those videos, which, you know, if you watch the news stations, they play it 14 million times, but what happened on that video was when they had the car stop, I mean, couldn't they shoot off the tires or something else? The thing took off again, and we'll have to get the details on that, but thank you for protecting people as they do. And these cops, by the way, don't need a pat on the back every 5 seconds. I think the news media proposed that idea that they're heroes. We need it. They don't do that. They go home and forget it and get up in the morning, go back to work, or the night, whatever kind of shift they're working. Same thing in prison, bailiffs in the court system, sheriffs, etc. But we are thankful that people are willing to do this, and it sounds as if fewer people are in this age from what I'm reading, but I don't have any valid proof of that. I guess all proof should be valid. But this is the Blog Talk Radio Network. It says Leading Edge Technology. Alan Libby is the CEO of BTR, and he made it all happen. And you, by the way, could have your own radio show in a matter of minutes. You just go to blogtalkradio.com and sign up for the show. And then you can schedule your show as often as you want. There's some certain restricted hours that aren't free, but they don't cost very much if you want to do between like 8 and 10 or 7 and 10, something like that. We pay a little bit of money, but not much. All right. Tonight's show, we already told you what it's going to be about. I think you're going to really enjoy this, and we won't be able to make the entire video audio presentation because it's about 57 minutes, but of course, go to booktv.org and type in Emily Gets Her Gun, and it'll take you to this, and it is really worth hearing. It is one of the most absurd things I've ever heard of in my life. You know, I've lived in states that don't have those kinds of restrictions in cities, but just incredible what they made this woman go through to get a firearm to protect her to protect herself. If we have time for any call-ins, you can call in at 347-996-5983, 347-996-5983, and do that. We got a blonde joke tonight, and I wrote this one. Here we go again with this one. How's this blonde joke? A blonde gets stopped for running through a residential area where the speed limit was 25 miles per hour. There are schools in this area and kids playing on the playground and all that. And she's doing 55 miles an hour going through this area. So the cop stops her, and then she says, roll down. And we said, well, why are you stopping me? And he says, I'm stopping you for running through this particular area at 55 miles an hour when the speed limit's 25. You're 30 miles an hour over the limit. I'm going to write you a ticket. He goes back to the car, gets all the information for her, and he goes back to the car, writes her out a ticket, brings the ticket back and gives it to her, and he notices something odd. She's got her leg up on the dashboard. She's taking off her shoe, and she's looking at her shoe, and she's turning around and around, and he notices that they're real high heels, about, you know, 4.5 inches high on those heels. And she looks up at him. She says, come on, get real. Do you believe I could really run through here at 55 miles an hour in these heels? What do you think? Okay, that's one I made up. I'd say it's fun to make up blonde jokes, actually. You keep your mind occupied when you got nothing else to do. Speaking of guns, let's listen to the public service announcement of the Ohio Gun Coalition. And they would like you to turn in your firearms, the criminals to turn in their firearms, not you to turn them in. and that way our streets will be safer.
Carrying concealed handguns in Ohio? It's a deadly idea. A message from the Ohio Coalition Against Gun Violence.
You know, I wonder what percentage of people who have a concealed carry license actually carry. I've seen data that shows that less than half, sometimes only about a third, even carry. And a lot of them don't carry because they're afraid that they'll make some type of mistake when the police officer stops them and, you know, some tragedy will happen as a result of that. I don't think that's a very real assumption, but things like that have, in fact, happened. Well, here's a green tip for tonight. Now, how about this one? This comes from Esma Floyd's book, 1001 Ways, Little Ways, excuse me, to Save the Planet. And here's one that we should be thinking about here this time of year. Draw at dusk, it says. At dusk, when the air outside begins to cool, your home is susceptible to losing more heat. Draw your drapes and shades at the dusk before it gets completely dark to help conserve energy. What do you think about that? Draw your shades before it gets dark. That's probably a good crime prevention tip, too, depending on where you live, right? Keep the window peepers away and that kind of stuff. Well, I could tell you some stories about those back in the Ice Age when I was a cop. They are weird people, no matter what they do. Anyway, let's go ahead and take a look at some of the news stories. Well, there's some crazy stuff going on tonight. I got more stories than I got time to do, but let's take a look at some of these things that are really interesting. Poor Sheriff Joe Arpaio, America's sheriff, the court now, a federal judge on Wednesday ordered the appointment of an independent monitor and a community advisory board to ensure that the Arizona sheriff is complying with constitutional requirements after finding his office engages in racial profiling. I really would like to see in that case what the definition of racial profiling is. I hear people talk about it all the time, and I ask them what it means, and they don't know. I have my own definition. It's depriving somebody's liberty based solely on their race, which is my definition. That's mine. Ordered the judge now ordered a monitor be appointed to oversee the agency's retraining of deputies and ensure the office is complying with constitutional requirements. And Sheriff Apaya, by the way, Maricopa County, he sheriffs the largest county in the state of Arizona. And, of course, the American Civil Liberties Union, they're ecstatic about this particular decision. They hail this as a victory, this particular ruling. It's a 59-page order. I'm going to read that thing. I'm sure it would have to be public. But the monitor sheriff Joe's attorney says the monitor cannot tell us what to do or what not to do. The court will make the ultimate decision on whether or not the Maricopa County Sheriff's Office is in compliance with its order. And he said we're at least pleased with that you're not going to have some local board or some monitor kind of running over you like they're the sheriff, as a matter of fact. But here's a guy that's trying to protect his community. He knows how to treat prisoners, deprive them of some liberties, and maybe they won't want to come back. Ladies and gentlemen, we have a new category of crime that's cropped up in at least two states, I think. It's called revenge porn. Mike, do you know what revenge porn is? Here's what it is. California Jerry Brown just signed a bill outlawing so-called revenge porn and levying jail time for people who post naked pictures of their former partners. In other words, a former girlfriend or a former boyfriend, you were in a situation where they took pictures of you, and they can post them to get back at you on the Internet. What, my Lord, what is not going on the Internet? We got more stories tonight about Twitter. I can't believe how these news channels on television are using Twitter like it's the truth. First of all, how do we know they're telling the truth in their Twitter statement? And secondly, how do we know that the person who says they are the one that's actually submitting the tweet? But it gets more complicated than that, actually, but I don't have time for it. The Civil Liberties Union, by the way, which I'm often on their side and often not, has opposed the bill, arguing it might restrict free speech rights, which has a concern in other states. I guess it's free speech to post naked pictures of former partners or wives or husbands or whatever, but isn't that weird? Okay, ladies and gentlemen, I saw it today. I got in my car and drive south on a road here in the city I live in, and I saw a young man in a ball hat. Was a college student. He was walking. He was text messaging. His thumbs were going at high speed. And another man, about almost another head taller than him, was walking toward him. And the guy walking toward him looked at him, said, you know, I'll kind of get out of the way. When he got out of the way, the guy that was text messaging ran into him anyway. They had a head-on collision. No fight over it, but the taller man was not happy, the man without the thumb. But here's what they say. The more texts you send, the worse you sleep. People who constantly message experience more stress in their friendships. So there are those who cannot live without their phone. As I used to tell students and have not that long ago, turn it off and live. Take a day and study shoes or the leaves or something like that. You might learn something. But apparently these people have excess sleep problems. They feel that if they don't answer, then somebody's going to say something bad about them. So this is the thought, because they feel pressured to reply to messages in the middle of the night. And because they sleep with their phone by their bed, they're often awakened by text messages. Having never sent a text message in my life, I don't really know the text messaging world. I don't care to, but we've talked on our show about the book Alone Together by Sherry Turkle, how some of these people are doing 10,000 of these things a week. I mean, think of this, 10, 15,000 a week. In fact, I just heard on television tonight that people are spending like, how much was it? 90 minutes? No, what the heck was it? 90? Oh, I can't believe it. It was like an incredible amount of time, like in a week. 900 minutes, something like that, doing this. No, it was more than that. It was like some of them were spending like 30% of their day, 40% of their day sending text messages. I think it was actually higher than that. Audrey, check on that for me. Let me know. But anyway, they're really in trouble. They also found that frequent text messaging is associated with more friendship-related stress, because texts are unable to convey subtle nuances in conversation. It can't convey subtle nuances in conversation. What? You can't say it all in 144 characters? For some people, maybe you could. For some people, that's a lot of words and hard to do. Anyway, that's incredible, isn't it? I'll skip that. It's a long one, but we now see Iran has now unveiled surveillance drones. I'm a big fan of drones, as you know, and we've done shows about that, and the best book on it out right now is Medea Benjamin's book, drone warfare, but she really studied it, and it's very well documented in that textbook or in that book. But anyway, Iran's now got a surveillance drone, and we just had one crash in New York, didn't we? Yeah, I think we did. Right, Mike? The thing was too low? It was too low, I think. Might have been too high, but anyway, it was someplace it wasn't supposed to be. I want to thank you folks that are listening tonight for paying your taxes. You know, we've been involved in the Afghanistan war and Iraq before that, still in Iraq. The war's over officially in Iraq, and the one in Afghanistan is winding down. The Department of Defense is facing a conundrum. It has just spent billions of dollars buying heavily armored personnel carriers. These things are designed to stand up to insurgent attacks, only to find out that it had run out of wars to use them in. The initial plan was to shove the vehicles, called MRAPS, Mine Resistant Ambush Protected, into a warehouse and kind of let them collect dust. But now they've decided to give them away. So here's what's happening. And so for the past couple of months, news reports have been popping up announcing that places like the of Freesboro, Tennessee, and Ohio State University have been receiving their own military-grade armored SUVs. What would Ohio State... Oh, I don't know. Never know. Could be for a football game, maybe. They might need one. But now it's Dallas's turn. The Dallas County Sheriff's Department traveled up to Fort Hood, not too far away, earlier this month and picked up their own International Max Pro, this MRAP. This truck has never seen any actual combat, having only been deployed stateside for training exercise. So it doesn't have any battle scars, so to speak. But I want to tell you, would you please grab onto your chair or wherever you're listening, because this will shock you. This thing costs $600,000, and it's never been used, and we're giving them away. Yeah, I mean, what in the world is going on? $600,000. That'll buy you a lot of Mercedes-Benz, won't it? Oh, I would think so. But anyway, that's the news for tonight. Just incredible, some of these things going on. All right. Talk, if you want some books about guns, I mentioned them before. John Lott's book, More Guns, Less Crime. More Guns, Less Crime, John Lott. It's been updated, I believe. History of the United States in 10 Firearms. That's by Kyle, the Navy SEAL that was killed. With Liberty and Guns for All, A Primer on America's Firearms Debate. Who wrote that one? Who did that one? Oh, I did. That's right. That's right. And then Emily Miller's book, Emily Gets Her Gun. So that's a little background stuff that if you're following the gun debate, you can take a look at those stories, and it will get you going. All right. Let's take a listen to Emily talking about her wonderful book called Emily Gets Her Gun. It's going to take me just a little while to set this up, so don't run away.
Happy to be here with Emily Miller, whose book just came out today. Emily Gets Her Gun, But Obama Wants to Take Yours. It describes, Emily, what happened after you decided in late 2011 that you wanted to get a gun in the District of Columbia, where handguns had been forbidden until the Supreme Court decided in the District of Columbia versus Heller case in 2008 that a handgun ban was unconstitutional. Because the Second Amendment, according to Justice Antonin Scalia's majority opinion, quote, surely elevates above all other interests the right of law-abiding, responsible citizens to use arms in defense of hearth and home, unquote. So you'd think it would have been straightforward in 2011, 3 years later, for you to just go out and buy a gun, but it wasn't. Tell us why you wanted one and tell us what happened when you took the first steps towards getting a gun.
Well, I wrote this book out of reaction to what had happened this year as the gun control laws that are in D.C. have spread through the country. Basically, since the horrific tragedy in Newtown, Obama, and mostly funded by Mayor Bloomberg, had pushed these laws through the country, and I had just gotten a gun myself in D.C. and saw in action how these gun control laws affect the law-abiding people. So while it took me 4 months and $435 in government fees to get a gun that I could still can't legally take out of my home. In other states, you just walk in a gun store and you do an FBI background check and walk out. So we've got gun crime rising in D.C. Rapes and sexual assaults are up 50% a year ago. Last year, assaults with a gun were up, robberies with a gun were up 20%, assaults with guns were up So all these gun crimes are going up, and people like me, the law-abiding, are having trouble getting guns. So I wrote this book because where these laws are being spread around the country, and it's not going to do anything to reduce crime. It's not going to do anything to make Americans safer.
Well, describe a little bit what exactly, how it came out in practice when you tried to buy a gun. You go into great lengths in the book, but give us a sense of what were the absurdities that you faced when you tried to actually do it.
Well, I was so overwhelmed by it. I went into the police station to start, and I just said, I'm here to get a gun. And I had no idea. I didn't ever owned a gun before. What inspired me was that I was a victim of crime. I was walked into a home invasion situation, and thankfully wasn't hurt, but there were a bunch of men outside. The police say most likely they had done a drug deal and they're trying to get some quick cash. I wasn't hurt, but it woke me up to the fact that if I had surprised them enough or something had happened, I was totally defenseless in my home. So that's what inspired me to do it. And I knew that, obviously, in Washington resident, I knew that the Supreme Court had overturned the 30-year gun ban, but I didn't realize what had happened since then. What happened was the Liberal City Council had to technically abide by the Heller decision, technically. But what they did is they put in place these incredibly complicated registration laws. So D.C. is one of the seven places in the country you have to actually register every gun you own. Mostly Chicago, New York, places like that. And they do it, I believe, to discourage people from getting, law-abiding people from getting guns. Of course, criminals are just buying off the street from each other. So that's what they're up to. And I didn't realize any of this going into it. I just thought I'd get it done. I knew it was a little bit hard. I ended up, after I walked into the police station that first day, I said, I'm here to get a gun. And I got all the paperwork, 22 pages of paperwork. And I was so overwhelmed by it. I sat down and tried to figure out what I had to do. And it was 17 steps. 17 things you had to go through. It actually ended up being about 22. I counted 17 and found more as I went along, but some of the most ridiculous ones was a five-hour test, a five-hour class I had to take, 4 hours in a classroom, just to be read the laws out loud.
Not to learn how to shoot a gun, but to learn what
the law. Well, 1 hour in the range, which wasn't learning to shoot, so that's not part of the requirement. It was just showing that you could hit the paper from 5 yards. And, I mean, frankly, you have to be blind and deaf to not get a piece of paper from 5 yards. I mean, it was not very telling. I would take a written test, a 20-question test, fingerprinted, a lipsticks test. I mean, it was one thing after another. I had to go to DMV twice, which anyone who's been to DMV in any major city knows that in and of itself. This is a deterrent having to go down there. Getting the gun transferred into the city was a hassle, everything. So it ended up, as I said, taking 4 months.
Well, they did challenge, I think, Dick Heller, the defendant in the original case that went to the Supreme Court, challenged those rewritten rules, but they were upheld in the federal court. What's happened since then?
Yeah, the Heller 2 decision, it's being appealed, and that's working its way through the court system. And I think I was pleased to see last year, through the course of my series coming out, the city council moved to make the registration process a little less difficult, and I count it now as 11 steps. It's not 17, it's 11. And, I mean, obviously the leverage that I had in writing the series and sort of scaring them is this pending case, because they don't want to get back to Supreme Court and get knocked back down again. And D.C.'s other big, and this is just a very D.C.-centric issue, and they want to have budget autonomy away from Congress, and they want to be a state. And they know the Republicans in the Congress are not going to allow either of those things while they have these unconstitutional firearms laws existing. So that's why they've moved in the past year with my series to change two of them.
Your series in the Washington Times.
Washington Times.
Which was also called Emily Gets Her Gun.
That's inspired me. Takeaway from Andy Gets Her Gun. That was a series.
Well, the laws that you describe and the absurdities they can result in are very similar to those in effect in New York City and Chicago, not in very many other places. When you say that you saw President Obama try to get similar laws passed around the country, or perhaps you meant in different states after Newtown there were laws passed that tightened up the regulations on gun possession, and a lot of those are not very similar to those in the district, though.
They are. I mean, the same laws are all over the place. It's a assault weapons ban. So five states passed new laws, from Colorado, which is the most shocking of all, which will be facing a recount, a recall election next week over it and a lawsuit, which a high capacity magazine ban now exists in Colorado. That threw me off 2 weeks in Washington, D.C., because the state power is the brand of gun I chose, and it came standard with a 13-round magazine. That's just what it did. So the best prices are online, but I couldn't buy it that way because it came with this 13-round magazine, and the one gun dealer in D.C. was illegal for him to even receive it that way because it was child sex. So I had to find a dealer who would be willing to take the factory box, open it up, and by the way, a 10-round magazine and a 13-round magazine look like this, but the 13-round one is a little piece of plastic here that stops it. So this is what's going to be going on in Colorado, and this also happened this year in Connecticut. And then, obviously, we're sitting here in New York City. The first one out of the gate was Governor Cuomo, and he pushed this through, which I suppose is written by Mayor Bloomberg, this ridiculous law saying that the maximum capacity magazines in New York City, in New York State, could be 7. Well, no one checked to find out if any guns were made with 7-round magazines. They aren't. So I think it's a 1911 pistol and a couple of small guns. So then because of that, they had to do a whole new fix in April to change that. And now they're saying, which I think is the most ridiculous thing of all, you can only load 7 rounds. I mean, can you imagine the criminals being like, dude, you hit 6. Stop. Go with the 7.
Well,
it's not going to do anything.
The nail on the head with what the problem that so many people have with gun control is that so many gun control laws, which may be well-intentioned, seem to be based on the idea that the best way to reduce murders, assaults, armed robberies, and other crimes involving guns is to make it as difficult as possible for everybody, including law-abiding citizens,
right,
to own or use a gun. New York City has the same idea. You've already criticized Mayor Bloomberg, who pushes that constantly and is now going to do it across the country. Would you agree, though, that, first of all, the Second Amendment protects a constitutional right? It recognized a common law right that everybody had had in the colonies right up to the Revolution, and it aimed to protect that. And that people who see that guns can be dangerous or a menace to public safety have to recognize that people who take that right seriously deserve to be taken seriously. I mean, very often it's kind of dismissed. Well, it's a relic. I'm sure we agree on that. Would you also agree that gun control laws that aim to keep guns out of the hands of people who everybody agrees should not have it, criminals, drug addicts, people like that, people with criminal records. Such rules are acceptable if we could ever agree on common ground.
That's the problem. That's the whole problem here. We've had all these studies, government studies, CDC, Harvard, one after another on the gun control laws such as universal background checks, assault weapons ban, high-capacity magazine, registration, carry ban, all those kinds. None of them reduce crime. In fact, crime has decreased. Gun crime alone has decreased 40% since 1991. So the past 20 years, gun crime is down 40%. Well, gun murders are down 40%.
All kinds of crime
but
are down. About
all kinds are down. But if we're just going to talk about firearms, you know, it's completely down. However, we have more guns in this country than we've ever had in history. There's 300 million guns in this country. So as gun, and especially the past year with what's been going on with gun sales, firearm sales are going like this. Gun crime is, okay, I can't do this very well. But you know what I'm trying to do. So one is paralleling. So gun crime is going down while gun ownership is going up. So while, if we want to reduce, and it's about 10,000, 11,000 people are killed each year by gun crime. About a quarter of those are felons and criminals. Not much we can do in that case.
Yeah. More are killed, they kill themselves in suicide.
Yeah, and I mean, that's for psychologists to figure out that situation. But if we're just talking about people who are murdered, you know, who aren't criminals themselves and acts, about, you know, 7,000 a day, we want to work on that issue. You know, it is decreasing. There are so many things that can be done that are already in existence that, obviously, like you said, the Guns and Control Act of 1963 says, if you are a felon, you can't have a gun. If you're mentally ill, you can't have a gun. If you're a drug dealer, domestic abuser, dishonored discharge from the military, illegal alien, any of those categories of people, it is illegal for them to have guns.
Right, that was 68. But
68, thank you. You're so much better at history stuff than I am. I appreciate that. So that is, we have these prohibitions, and we all agree. I mean, does anybody want a criminal or a drug addict to have a gun? I mean, that's the whole point, is that we...
The question is, how do we...
We all want to be safe.
How do we keep... make laws that do that and don't penalize...
Well, we have a law that does that. We have a law that says that. It's about making those laws effective and enforcing. I think the biggest solution that needs to be done is getting the mental health records into the NICS system. And NICS is obviously the FBI's background check system. When you go to buy a gun, they do a check, and they see if you are in this prohibited category.
The NICS system is the National Instant Criminal Background Check system that applies to sales of guns by federally licensed dealers in gun shops or gun shows, but not through private sales, which might be 10, 15, 20, or even 40%. The estimates are...
Right. Well, Obama says 40 because that's convenient for him, but that number is one of the things that's out of my book is such a falsehood because it's taken from, as you know, a study from 1997. So what do we really know about modern stuff? But it goes that old. But of that, 28% are friends and family. So I'm not going to give my gun to my uncle, who's a drug addict and is abusing his wife. Like, if it's friends and family, you know each other. This has been happening through the course of American history.
You might not, but suppose you're a criminal and you get a gun from a friend or a family.
Well, that's what they do. About 40% get them from the friends and family. But they're probably criminals as well. I mean, they know who they are.
And they're not going to be deterred by a law in your...
Or they wouldn't be criminals. You know, that's we call them criminals because they don't really care. But we all, like, I am the one going to the DMV to get my gun.
But how about the people who get straw buyers, girlfriends,
yeah,
or
and that's a tough one.
Who can buy guns, buy them somewhere, and then give them to them illegally.
Right. And that's a very common... The ATF was at 47%. That's a huge number.
That's as many, that many criminals get their guns.
And straw purchasers.
Right.
And what that is...
It's a sale, isn't it? I mean, if it's...
No, basically what it is, like, you send your girlfriend in, she doesn't have a felony record or drug addiction, and she buys the gun. So the key to that is one of the other things I say is one of the solutions that we really can focus on that's already involved is the crime in going through your NICS check and failing it is lying. So when that girlfriend goes in and says, I'm buying this gun, and she's writing out that form, that's a perjury charge. And so the only way to stop these things is for enforcement of those perjury charges. And the problem with this administration is they don't see that as a priority. Eric Holder, Attorney General, said, we don't have time for this. I interviewed Jim Baker, who's the NRA Director of Federal Affairs, and he was in a meeting at the White House. They had one meeting where they had the gun groups and they were developing their agenda. And they've known each other for years, Biden and Baker. And Baker said to the Vice President, Vice President, with all due respect, you're not, prosecutions are down in your administration of these purchase charges, of these NICS fails checks, these NICS denials. Got to go after this. This is how we get these guys off the street to stop them. And the Vice President says to Baker, we don't have time to build these petty charges. So that disconnect is such a problem because in order to stop people from doing assault purchases, there has to be a deterrent. If the girlfriend thinks what happens, how the process works, the FBI does a negative, a denial, figure something out, and says it's ATF. The girlfriend thinks she might actually go to jail for 5 years over this. They might stop her. And secondly, you also get people like that off the streets when you go after them. You know, these are criminals already. We know that. The only way to stop them is to know that there's a deterrent. And
well, I think a lot of people on the gun control side of the debate would agree with you on that. After Newtown, the president, of course, reacted, as many people did in the country, to that horrific slaughter of innocent children by letting or proposing a number of measures, including administrative measures that he could take without congressional action. But he asked for, and Congress eventually considered on April 17th, the Senate considered a bunch of different proposals, amendments to an underlying gun control law, and they all failed. One of them was, of course, a ban on that Diane Feinstein had proposed on semi-automatic so-called assault rifles, like the one that Adam Lanza, the killer in Newtown, used to shoot the kids with. There were other measures. One of them was a bipartisan measure that Senators Manchin and Toomey and Schumer had proposed that would make universal background checks a requirement. Another one was a proposal to criminalize straw purchasing and make it punishable by 15 years in prison. Another one was a law against gun trafficking, bringing guns across state lines, criminals bringing them across, and that was also to be punishable by...
These are already against the law.
Already there, but they wanted to strengthen them. Yet all these amendments failed to reach 60 votes, which were required under the rules of the debate. I'd say, why would people who actually support strengthening such laws oppose them when they came to a vote in the Senate?
Well, as I explained in my book, there were, two different trains moving down that track in the Senate. What happened in Newtown was, a decent slaughter. I don't know what other word to use. Just one of the most horrific things I think that ever happened in America. Shattered everybody. And what I find to be unfortunate is President Obama has had this anti-gun control agenda plan, as has Dianne Feinstein, since before he was reelected, before these legislation has been in the works, and they announced them all right within 2 days of these children being killed. To me, it's shameful that they use this opportunity to push a political agenda as opposed to saying this is a horrific, horrific thing that happened, but there is no law that would have stopped. This killer, Lanza, broke every law. He stole his mother's gun.
Murdered her.
He murdered these children. He went on in gun-free zone school. If there was a law, he broke it. And so when it came to this time, Obama pushed this because he really needed to get the momentum, and he had Mike Bloomberg's money behind him. Mike Bloomberg sent $12 million leading up to that election to pastoring ads around the country on senators he thought he could switch on his direction. And I sat through all those hearings on the Hill. Not one person on the Democratic side, or I shouldn't say, because it really wasn't split down party lines. The Democrats were split, the Republicans were on one side. No one said this law would have stopped Newtown. It never came up because it wouldn't have. So they're exploiting them without saying that we could stop our children from being taken to school.
Exploiting them is one way to look at it. Having a normal human response to a horrific tragedy is another way, isn't it? Give Obama a little credit. He didn't just come out and try to pass a slew of gun laws because it had always been on his agenda.
In 48 hours.
No, it wasn't so fast.
It was on Sunday at the prayer service.
He didn't come out with the
whole thing. On that Sunday, the shooting was on a Friday. Saturday morning, Bloomberg said, we need to pass an agenda now.
Bloomberg said that.
Sunday morning at the prayer service, Obama said, I'm going to launch a task force.
Biden chaired.
Why?
It took a while, though, didn't it?
No, he said it went within a month.
Yeah, but it wasn't 2 days after
He switched to politics in 2 days. Instead of letting his kids are still in school.
If you're going to strengthen legislation, even some authority on the books, you've got to do it through politics. How else are you going to get it passed by Congress?
I found it shameful because not one thing that was proposed would have prevented those children's death.
And I agree with you.
And I think he agrees with that.
None of these measures could have stopped Adam Lanza.
You've got crazy people. And look, mass shootings, there's another confusion with the public, and I try to clarify that in my book. Mass shootings get media coverage like nothing else.
They're spectacular and
bloody
and horrifying.
And I think people relate to them more than city crime, whereas people in the city, urban crime is much more frequent.
That's the big problem, not the mass shooting.
Exactly. The way the politicians go after these mass crimes and make mass shootings go after them, and the media as well, the public has this misconception that mass shootings are increasing. And the Congressional Research Service did a study this spring, looked at them for the past 10 years, said they're exactly the same. You know, some obviously some years we have unfortunately horrifically more, but it's about 18 people a year. And so one of the things, you know, I think it's important for people to know, because, you know, I have my girlfriends come to know that, you know, I'm an expert on this issue, and they're terrified to send their kids to school. And that's going back to what you were saying about the president. And as I wanted to, I would have loved this president to, instead of making it worse and exaggerating and making people more scared, say to the country, this is like almost fair. This is a one-off. I mean, talk to families, but then if you speak to the country, your children are safe. You're not in more danger. You know, we, first of all, one-third of the country, school, public schools have armed guards already. So those schools, we know, have a deterrent. And mass shootings are not getting worse. You can go to some at Aurora. You can go to the movie theater. Go to school. Don't, you know, it's where I'm having, like, friends.
And maybe then he might have said, and let's get together and talk about things we might be able to agree on that could at least help make these things less frequent. One of them is, well, two of these are things that Wayne LaPierre of the NRA actually came out and supported after the president made his proposals public. One is armed guards in school. And as you said, a lot of people said, oh, that's ridiculous, you know, to think turning the schools into repositories for guns, how's that going to keep people safe? And yet, as you just said, one-third of all schools across the country have armed guards.
And when schools are thousands more, which are the urban, more dangerous ones, it's in the 60th percentile. And so, you know, Wayne LaPierre made that comment, and the people who were outraged by it were mostly the liberal media.
Another comment he made, Wayne LaPierre, was, you know, he'd better do something to improve the way we detect and treat mental illness of the kind that clearly was behind Adam Lanza's actions in Newtown. And that actually was part of the universal background check proposal that Manchin, Toomey, and Schumer proposed. Lots of measures in there to strengthen the ability of the states to use information they get from treatment of mentally ill people and make it available, make the names of such people available to the FBI for the national check system. Yet that, too, failed to make 60 votes.
As did Grassley-Cruz was the alternative, and it was a Republican sponsored by Senator Ted Cruz and Chairman Grassley, ranking Republican Grassley on the Senate Judiciary Committee. That's when the Republicans stood behind, and a bunch of Democrats, because it didn't have this universal background check. And the problem with this, you know, I say in my book, the universal background check is sort of the assault weapons ban of this year. The assault weapons ban was created by an anti-gun activist deliberately, and we have his own words, Josh Sugarman, saying people will mistakenly think when we talk about assault weapons that there are automatic weapons, meaning the kind you take in war, machine guns. See, that's exactly what he said. They'll think it's machine guns. It's a really great way to make inroads with people because the public will be confused and they'll think they're outlawing machine guns. They'll also wrongly think that machine guns are on the street. Now, he also, the President of the United States, all this year, repeatedly, you've got to get weapons of war off the streets. Got to get machine guns off the streets. He said, actually, at one point, those poor children in Newtown were killed by semi-automatic, I mean, fully automatic guns. He actually corrected himself to mislead. And
it's wrong.
It's incorrect. And, you know, I part of why I'm writing this book is just to get facts out there. Is machine guns or true automatic guns, which is you pull a trigger, as many bullets come out until you stop, are at war. They're in Afghanistan. Our military has them. Some of our police have them. For civilians, they've been highly regulated since 1934. They're not used in crime. Because they're so rare, they haven't been manufactured in 30 years, they're very expensive.
Half a million of them or so in private
hands. Yeah, and that's the point. Half a million in private hands, and they're never used in crime.
It sounds like you support that thing.
Well, I think they're a reasonable thing. I mean, obviously, they're reasonable limits. I mean, we don't want felons. You know, I don't want a criminal having a fully automatic weapon. We don't want an Adam Lanza having a fully automatic weapon. But I don't think he can afford $20,000, $30,000 to get one and an ATF check and a $200 fee. And, you know, there's a lot to get through.
So, you know, that control has been effective, getting that kind of weapon out of the hands of everybody, practically, not just criminals, but everybody. It was originally aimed at criminals, the mob,
right,
back in the days of prohibition.
Right. That's why they had this. But, you know, part of that whole thing, that, well, I actually was at ATF a month ago. They let us shoot all the banned guns. So much fun.
It is fun. I've got a semi-automatic version of the AK-47, which I heard a lot coming the other way when I was in the war in Vietnam. But
for me, that was one of them was shot. They all wouldn't let you in automatic mode, but I was like, how in the world are they walking around the world with these things? They're so heavy, you know. But one of the things was the Tommy gun in there, and I'm like, this thing weighs 10 tons, and it's this big. And that's another misconception people think, because Obama's saying weapons of war on the street.
Well, he did say,
no one's walking down the streets with rifles.
He did say at one point, these aren't the problem. The problem is criminals using cheap handguns.
And he said that in a debate last year, which I went...
It was Mitt Romney.
Okay, so now we're going to go after...
No, he said they're cheap handguns, but...
Yeah.
But he wasn't trying to get the price raised. Well, he was pointing out that they and not semi-automatic rifles are the...
Which is fine. He's never proposed any kind of... Thankfully, yes, proposed regulating. But in 1996, when he was running for Illinois State Senate, he wrote in a questionnaire on a variety of issues that said, do you support the banning of handguns? He wrote, yes.
That's back before he ever became a national figure.
Right, when he had to run a national election.
But in his first term, what did he do on gun control?
Well, he couldn't because he was running for re-election. Gun control's a loser.
You don't give him any credit at all for maybe just... responding the way a normal human being would to the...
Barack Obama?
Newfound.
No. See, that man has been political. He was born political, and he has a political agenda. Now, look what happened to Clinton. Clinton pushed through the 1994 crime bill or assault weapons ban, whatever you want to call it. He lost the House. House has been pro-gun ever since. Most of this country, 47% of the country has a gun in the home. This is a country that believes in the Second Amendment and the right to keep and bear arms. Politicians know they can't win a national election bashing guns.
Okay, we'll take a short break and we'll be back in a few minutes.
On the Go, Afterwards is available via podcast through iTunes and XML. Visit booktv.org.
I talked to the head of the Gun Show Association, and because ATF has been even more regulating than normal, obviously the last 2 years, it's up to about 90% at gun shows. And I think that... gun show loophole is another phrase that was invented to confuse the public, especially places that culturally there aren't gun shows, they're not used to it, like the Northeast and places like that. And places like for Virginia, where they have gun shows all the time, people go and they know it's not like a hotbed of criminals running around shooting each other. But to someone who just doesn't know the issue, and maybe a suburban mom and isn't familiar, it does sound a little bit scary, but it's not a source of criminal guns. And so the reason that we could not get 60 votes in the Senate is because the Grassley Cruz alternative was a way to, like as we said, strengthen the straw purchasers, get those mental health records into NICS, all these kinds of things, strengthen the prosecutions of the denial, those things that are like solutions that people agree on. Whereas Nancy Toomey was saying, hey, we live next door to each other, but we're going to have to drive all the way down the street, find a gun dealer to do an FBI check, and frankly, you know, and I put this document in my book, there's a memo that was written to the Justice Department. I've asked the Justice Department repeatedly who they wrote it for, where it went, but they won't say. The NRA got a copy of it. And in it, it says that background checks, universal background checks, which is their new vanilla term, will not do anything to reduce crime unless we have a registration of all the guns in America. And the public overwhelmingly opposes the universal registration.
I think you overstate that. I was drawn to it, and I think it's a good thing that you did publish it in the book so people can see what it says. It was analyzing what universal checks could do, and it says they're insufficient for ensuring that firearm owners remain eligible. You know, you can legally own a gun, but then go commit a bank robbery or something and become ineligible if you're convicted of the crime, and there's not a good mechanism for checking back on people like that.
Right.
And it does say that most states do not have a registry of firearm ownership, so consequently it's hard to go back and find out if you're getting the right people, if you're doing universal background checks, barring the right people from guns. But it doesn't anywhere say that we need a federal system of registration.
Yeah, just go down to the very bottom. Gun registration continues checks. Universal checks are insufficient for ensuring blah, blah, blah. recovering guns.
The last paragraph.
Right, recovering guns from those that become ineligible is likely effective.
Right.
Okay, there's evidence from three studies. Let's get to that.
The
challenge is implementing.
That's it.
More broadly, is that most states do not have a registry of firearms ownership. Currently, mixed background checks are destroyed within 24 hours. That's by law in Congress.
Right.
Some states maintain registries of ownership. Gun registration aims to, one, increase owner responsibility by directly connecting an owner with a gun at the national registry.
Right.
Two, improve law enforcement's ability to retrieve guns from owners from prohibited from possessing firearms.
Right, but that doesn't say they want under federal gun
registration. Yes, that's exactly what it says.
Existing
gun registration states. Also allows for the monitoring of multiple gun purchases in a short period of time.
That's what it does. That's just
this is the recommendation. Summary of select firearm violence prevention strategies by the Deputy Director of the National Justice Department, National Institute of Justice. I mean, they have a little Twitter summary on these things. So the Twitter summary on universal background checks, effectiveness depends on ability to reduce child purchasing, requiring gun registration and an easy gun transfer process.
In states where they have it.
Well, we can disagree on that.
Well, I think you go too far.
You do? Well, I don't. Because I believe, I look back at Obama's career and I see him from the beginning saying, I want to ban all handguns. And not just 1996, when he was running for Illinois Senate. He expanded on it that I would like to ban handguns. So there's a political, there's a history here of this. And then when he got into the Senate, he was one of only 30 members who voted for regulating of ammunition.
Well, that's true. But in his first 4 years as president, what did he do? Two things. One, approved, signed a law that lets you take a gun if you own one aboard in a container aboard Amtrak trains.
Mm-hmm.
And two, take a gun onto an international park.
Right.
That's all he did.
Because he wants to get reelected. And no one's ever gotten reelected who's run on gun control. Or elected, I should say. No.
I don't think we're ever going to get to the point where people who support gun rights, and I'm one of them, I believe it is a constitutional right, and I wish that people who support gun control, like Mayor Bloomberg, would take that more seriously than they do, but you'll never find common ground. There must be things we can agree on, like improving mental health records and making sure that states provide the names of people who shouldn't be able to buy guns from dealers, get into that federal FBI registry. We'll never be able to make progress on that and make things like Newtown, if not impossible, at least maybe less likely to happen.
Well, that's a very thorough discussion. I think what this points out is the perpetuity of these arguments and the bits of pieces of the arguments about gun control and gun safety. And also it points out, and these people help to diminish that the ignorance that people have about firearms, like people about assault weapons. Most people would know assault weapon if it walked in their front or back door. They don't want that to happen, but you know what I mean. So very interesting. Go to booktv.org and look, type in Emily Miller in the search box, and you can hear the remaining 35 minutes of their presentation. It's a very good discussion of the problems we're having with firearms control and safety, and they're never going to be over. But we do know that many, many people in a year's time use a firearm to ward off a felon. Most of the time they don't shoot them, they just pull it out and 90% the felon takes off. So they have value. And if you've known many people who've had that happen, it's very convincing when they tell you that story. Okay, that's it for tonight. Join us next week if you can. We'll have Vera Lynn sign off the show, and she'll sing "We'll Meet Again."
We'll meet again. Don't know when. Don't know when. But I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Like you always do, till the blue skies drive the dark clouds far.